The book that I'll be referring to from time to time and is the background for this session is the one I have listed on the board, On Becoming a Musical Mystical Bear. The author is Matthew Fox. The OP after the name is to tell you just about all I know of him, and that is that he's a member of the Paulist Order in the Roman Catholic Church, and the book is the Paulist Press. The book is in the library, along with a couple of other of Fox's books, one of which is We All the Way Home. That's another one of his books. So he has interesting titles. They're also in the bookstore. So if you're interested in following up more in detail, it's available in the library and in the bookstore. Here's the cover. Can you see the cover? And I have noted that ordinarily I would not pick up a book with a picture of a bear beating a drum with wings and flowers in its mouth and with that title and take it seriously. But my brother-in-law, who was at a conference where Matthew Fox spoke, took the trouble actually to buy the book and give it to me. So I thought if Mel was that serious about it, at least I could do would be to try to start to read it. And as soon as I got into the preface, I was hooked on it and found it to be a very, for me, important book. The title and the cover make it look frivolous, and there is a sense of frivolity in the theme, but the content is cannot be dismissed solely as frivolous. So I recommend it to you. Okay. One of the things that Matthew Fox says, and it's not at the beginning of the book, it comes toward the end, but it to me it's a good sentence for capturing interest, is that to be adult means to know when to say yes and when to say no and how to say it effectively. That grabs you right off, doesn't it? To be adult means to know when to say yes, when to say no, and how to say it effectively.
Question is anyone ever an adult?
Okay. Yeah. Adulthood then may be something that we approach rather than arrive at. To take that apart a little bit, I'll stimulate your thinking. I think yours is already stimulated as to the number of occasions that we have which seem to require a yes or no answer. In our personal life, in our families, with our children, with husband or wife, the need to say yes or no is constantly before us. And the point that to be adult means to know when to say one and when to say the other. And I would add, on a practical basis, also when to say maybe. Now that immediately soften somewhat the impact of the book. And Matthew Fox does not put the maybe in there, but I'm just saying that sometimes it's as difficult to say maybe when that seems to be appropriate as to say yes or no, which is what is demanded. And then the other side of that is how to say it effectively. In other words, effectively would mean to me in such a way that it is heard as our answer. It comes with an authority that makes it believable. So even though it isn't agreed with, at least the person to whom we're making that statement understands it as, yes, Wally does indeed mean yes in this case, or no. And while I may not agree with him, I'm at least realize that this is what he means. Because so often we get the response, oh, you don't really mean that, do you? Why don't you think about it a little more? Okay. So to say it effectively would be in one case, to say it with an authority or a conviction that leads people to accept it as our answer. I think also to say it effectively would mean if the answer is no, that we have an alternative to suggest. That we would say, no, my answer to this is no, but this is what I could say yes to that applies to it in some way. So sometimes the answer when we say no to our children, for example, and the child says, why? We would like to answer, because I said so. And sometimes that works, but sometimes it's effective to say no to this, but you can do this, or I'll agree to that. And if our answer is yes, to make that yes effective would be to have some plan or means of implementing that yes. My answer is yes, and this is what I intend to do about it. Okay. So, a basic statement underlying what Matthew Fox is getting at in becoming a musical mystical bear is to enable us to be ready to know when to say yes, when to say no, and how to say it effectively. Now, I think if we could think of some of the things in our personal life when the yes or no answer is called for. We were talking last night about homosexuality, and that was clearly, at least a part of that is that something we say yes to or something we say no to, and why, and how do we go about that? Our occupational life, I think, confronts us with varieties of opportunities to say yes and no. Sometimes do we say yes to a promotion? Do we say yes or no to a particular policy? And those kinds of occasions. As well as the very large society affecting, global affecting issues which we've been talking about here at Holden. Matters having to do with the use of natural resources, nuclear weaponry, that vast number, those things that were brought up in the Global 2000 report that some of us have looked at. And when we think of these, we think of most yes and no decision-making opportunities or challenges do in some way affect life as a whole. They're life-affecting things. And that's why these yes or no situations do get us emotionally as well as intellectually involved, because we perceive specific things about life or life as a whole being at stake in how we answer. Now, the nuclear weaponry thing is easy to get a hold of. We can see how a yes to proceed with the buildup of nuclear arms or a no to stop and actually to reduce, we can see how easily those become world-affecting, total life-affecting decisions. But I think it isn't only those major ones that have something to do with life as a whole. And that means that if they affect life, then life is some way going to be different on a smaller or larger scale because of our yes or no. And then that then has impact on the next decisions that we make. So we put these yes or no decisions into the context of the whole of life, the whole of our life, the whole of the life of our community, the whole of the life of the globe. So I believe, and this would be another point of Matthew Fox, that the attitude that we have toward life as a whole, the attitude of life as a whole of which these decisions are a part, at least unconsciously affect our yes or no answer. So when we say yes or no to a given situation, Matthew Fox is saying that that's going to be consciously or unconsciously affected by how we look at life as a whole. And he also goes on to say if we become more conscious of how we feel toward life as a whole, that will help us to make sharper, more consistent, and more effective decisions, so that our yes and no decisions on particular matters reflect how we look at life as a whole, how we interpret it, what we want it to be. So that when I make a specific yes or no decision, I would like that to some way further life as I would like it to be, or strengthen life as I understand it to be and would like it to continue. So if we can make conscious our unconscious feelings toward life, that will help us in an adult way to know when to say yes and when to say no, and how to say it effectively. So a basic question for Matthew Fox in becoming adult is to answer the question, how I feel toward life. And I'd like us to think about that for a few moments and see what response comes to you rather spontaneously. Here is the question that I would like, or the statement I would like you to complete. The way I feel about life is. The way I feel about life is. Give a little thought to that for a moment. And then if you could maybe out loud say you have completed that sentence. So there's no right or wrong answers here. This is just how you complete that.
The word that came to my mind is precious.
All right. The way I feel about life is that life is precious.
Yeah.
Would that be okay? Just to fit right into my structure here. Okay.
You want a single word or a three or four pages?
Well, you say what you want, and I'll write down what I... But see, someone else spoke at the same time.
Complicated.
Okay.
Opportunity.
Okay, opportunity.
Everyday challenge.
Adventurous.
Anyone else?
Does it have to be one word?
No.
I was thinking of life as a road with many choices to be made, and each how I answer yes or no to each choice will determine in the long run how closely I come to becoming the person God has planned for me to become.
Okay. I'll shorten that a bit. There's a lot in that sentence. I think life is a road with many choices. Life is a road, the goal of which is to become the person God wants me to be. And that involves many choices. Okay. Any others? Linda?
I would say that it's full of pain and also mystery, but it's worth it.
Pain, which is worth it, did you say? Okay. Does the worth it go with the mystery as well as? Okay. All right. That says mystery in case it's not clear.
Learning from error.
Okay.
Life is
learning. As a matter of interest, either from those of you who contributed or in your own thinking, are you aware of your being here at Holden as in any way influencing how you're feeling about life at the moment?
Sure.
Well, that was more affirmation of that than I expected. Could you, someone, say something about that? You had mentioned how that...
Well, I put down joy.
Uh-huh.
I think everybody should capture it.
Okay.
This is so relaxed and, you know, comforting and beautiful compared to normal circumstances. And you're not on your job and, you know, there's no pressure and it's just... It's almost a paradise. You know, you get back on the boat and go leave here, and then, you know, I think, at least for me, I'd be picking different words than I'm presently on the board, mostly.
What? You want to suggest one that's not on the board?
Oh, at the moment, no.
I see. I see. When you get off the boat, you might. I understand.
Yeah, right. Yeah, back in the real world.
Okay. I thought hog farming was paradise.
Anyone else indicate how what's happening here at Holden is influencing how you're feeling about life right now? Yeah?
For me, it's been a real challenge or crystallizing of some thoughts for me. Things that maybe I've just not seriously thought about.
Okay.
and I guess I feel like I'll not be quite the same after I do that.
Okay.
Look for new talents. No, much said yes to from such get me about new talents.
Uh-huh.
Get new talents. We got new in here. We want to go out and think about the talents that you get.
Okay. And you are?
I think old enough me to get back on track where I've perhaps gotten a little lost and give me a chance to think of rather than react to direct new connections.
Okay. Chuck?
Ambiguity is the word that comes to mind in terms of life. And I think that Holden contributes to the ambiguity. Here I am, really sort of running away. And you can feel guilty about that, or you can feel strengthened. You know, even this experience is a bit ambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
Here we talk about all these issues, and we sit in this very comfortable place. Mm-hmm. That's ambiguous.
Yeah. Linda?
For me, it's been kind of a struggle because I've been here long enough to, so that it hasn't been a paradise or a vacation prolonged.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of struggled with that a lot at first until I realized that there was a lot of ambiguity and pain and struggle here, and that people bring that as that's just life wherever you are. And sometimes when you're in a beautiful setting, it tends to want to be covered over and then explodes, you know, all the more with some of the people that are here for a long time, or you see that even in this setting there are people have so much pain inside them that needs to come out. And also that same struggle with being at a place that's so nice and beautiful and talking about things that are so important and that really affect you, and you feel basically powerless while you're here.
I was one of the first nights we were here. There was a Vespers prayer from the congregation invited, and someone prayed for those at Holden who are feeling alienated while they're here. And I thought, that's strange. You know, people aren't supposed to feel alienated at Holden. But the fact is that these things are here, and perhaps may get covered up because there's a feeling that we all ought to feel good about being at Holden, and if you're not feeling good about it, there's something wrong, and you really ought not to say it. And so it can kind of work back on itself, but if it can come out, and I think that's the idea of many of these sessions, is to give opportunity for the things that are behind these various words of challenge, adventure, pain, and so on, can come out and be dealt with in a situation, perhaps, where the consequences aren't immediately here. In other words, we have time to think about them in a situation where we're not under pressure immediately to give the yes or no answer. Think about it a little more distance and then go back to them. Yeah.
So I was thinking how easy it is for me to speak as a guest of Holden rather than a staff. But it gives me a chance to know that there are other people in the world that believes in a God, godly future. In the real world, sometimes you pass a week's time without being able to do the witness that you think you should be doing because it's not receptive.
Yeah.
Here, everyone's interest in basic quality of life.
Yeah, it's interesting. There is a, despite the differences, there is a common base there that we can disagree from. Well, my observation as I look at how we are feeling about life, those who volunteered to put something up here, is essentially positive. The only word which standing by itself would be negative might be pain, but noted that the person who suggested pain added, but it's worth it. There is the word itself, hopeful, precious, opportunity, which I think in themselves are very positive words, and then some phrases that probably in themselves are neither positive nor negative, but probably if we would work at them would tend to be. In other words, life is complicated, it was not necessarily bad. That there are challenges, that we learn from error, adventurous choices, mystery, ambiguity, maybe words with more or less comfort in them, but I think come out at least as essentially positive words. Well, Matthew Fox would say then, if we would follow that, that when we make our yes or no answers, that they would be informed by a basically positive view of life, either as we're experiencing it now or as we think it ought to be. Well, there's some sense about life that's operating here, which makes it seem good to us, or if not good in the sense that it's paradise, at least good in the sense that it's worth dealing with. And that when we're faced with the complications and the challenges and the choices, that going through the pain of making them is worth, or life is worth the effort that's required of us. So that we would be basically life-affirming positive people. H. Richard Niebuhr, in his book, The Responsible Self, defines faith as trust. And trust, or faith, is either trust or distrust. Faith is the way we look at, finally, the way we look at that which calls life into being. And if we push our faith, our belief, our understandings far enough, finally we'll come to the point where we're really saying, I either trust God or I don't trust God. I consider God either as friend or as enemy. And therefore I can respond to God either as friend or as enemy. So behind life is God, and how we look at God as either enemy or friend then is going to inform how we look at life generally. And I would say that because probably we can assume that all of us have in our background and our continuing life faith in God, and that our understanding of God as it has been taught to us and as we've discussed it is that God is good and that what God calls into being is good, that would account for this basically positive view toward life that we have. Then I think we could examine our lives in terms of particular decisions that we've made. This is something you might do on your own. And to ask whether those decisions do indeed look as if we trust God, or look as if we don't trust God. And if they reflect a basic trust in God, then we could see some consistency in our life. If they reflect a basic distrust in God, looking at God as the enemy, looking at life as the enemy, looking at other people as the enemy, then that probably means that we need to re-examine our thinking about God. And which is out of balance? Is it our understanding of God that is incorrect, or is it the decisions that we make, the life that we lead, that is out of synchronization with our understanding of God? Well, Matthew Fox says that if you look at the way people answer the question, the way I feel about life is, you'll come to three conclusions. Now, memorize what these are. Okay, got them? Okay. While I'm erasing that, I'm thinking of reasons for having left it on. But he says that life is real rather than abstract. I would say that our answers reflected that when we think of life, we think of something real, something that we are engaged in as persons. No one gave philosophical answers. Life is, I can't even think of an abstract answer. Maybe that's part of being here. But life is something that's very real. When we talk about life, we immediately know what we can relate to our own personal existence in terms of life. Life is real rather than abstract. I think we could recall some biblical phrases which would reflect that, and I think particularly of the statements of Jesus particularly in John, where he says, for example, I am the resurrection and the life. That life is so real that we say, Jesus says, I am life. Now, if we need any more concrete definition of life than that, it would be difficult to come across, to say, I am, if Jesus is the one in whom we believe. And Jesus says, I am life. This is the living, breathing, flesh and blood person, Jesus, saying, I am life. Then life becomes very real. Life is not something that exists in some perfect order somewhere else. Jesus himself is life. Or the phrase, I am the bread of life. Again, bread symbolizing that which really is the material stuff which sustains life. So that if we're saying that our own responses indicate that life is very real, and now I'm suggesting that Scripture taken as a whole and in some of its parts, and Jesus as we understand him, the incarnation, confirm that understanding of life as something that is real. It doesn't wait for some other existence, but right now Jesus is life. Jesus is the bread of life. The second word that Matthew Fox uses to describe life is mystery. Now it's interesting that that was one of the words that was suggested. The way I feel about life is that life is mystery. And the opposite of mystery for Fox is problem. Now, this concept is a key to the book, and the understanding is that life is mystery. So let me tell you what Matthew Fox has in mind when he speaks of life as mystery rather than problem. Mystery is something that one is caught up in, that is not before us in its entirety. Mystery is that which stops us short. Mystery is that which attracts us outside of ourselves, even outside of our world, certainly outside of our head. Mystery is that which is bigger than oneself. Mystery is that which touches a need within. And he says, adult life is a life aware of the mysterious dimension of life. Life is life with mysteries. Now, I feel that as we've been talking about environment, as we talk about the space around us, as we deal with people, that the mystery of life, as Fox is speaking of it, does seem to be part of the Holden experience. When you want to talk about the environment, we live at the corner of 33rd and Esmond Street in Richmond, and California, and that seems to do in describing the space in which we live in Richmond, and it's not very mysterious. But if you try to describe the location of Holden in terms of where you would find this place located, and you start talking about kind of in the glacial valley of the Cascade Mountains, all of a sudden it's a much bigger thing. It's not something that's right there in front of you, but it's something that can't be encompassed in its entirety. Now, problem, on the other hand, is something which bars one's passage. It's there in front of you and something you've got to deal with. It's there all at once. It's an object outside of me. It's an obstruction that may be resolved by removal or rearrangement. And he says adult life recognizes the difference between problem and mystery. Now let's think about that for a moment. Life as mystery rather than problem. Our answers, I think, reflected more the mystery than the problem side of it. I think when we said life is complicated, that could be looking at it as a problem, something that's got to be figured out, if we could figure it out. But I think not necessarily, because when we're trying to describe the complicated, it might come out very much as mystery. On the other hand, I think that we could think of, if we think about the way we deal with life oftentimes, it is as a problem. The life may be the individual that you're needing to deal with at that moment. And that individual may be confronted as a problem that needs to be solved. A student comes into my office and says, I'm supposed to graduate next Sunday, and I've got an F. And I can't graduate with an F. What do I do? Well, at that moment, that person becomes a problem to be solved for me, and would tend to deal with that person entirely in terms of that particular problem. But I think I would find that in order to understand the particular problem and to be helpful, I would have to get beyond that particular problem, begin to think of that individual as a person, mystery, that I'm not going to solve entirely, particularly in the 3 days before Sunday. The same with the environment. This mountain up here could be seen, in fact was seen in the history of Poland, as a problem to be solved. There was iron ore in there, or whatever else they were pulling out of there, silver, copper. It became a problem. How do we get that out of there in the most economical way so we get a profit, get it out of the mountain and into the... instead of a mystery, the mountain is a mystery to be kind of enjoyed and responded to. So at the base of what Matthew Fox wants to say is that life ought to be seen as mystery rather than problem. And let me give you some of the mysteries that he refers to specifically so you get a little better idea. Here are some of the mysteries about life. He first of all speaks of life as the primordial mystery. Now there he's saying that life itself, as we think about it, becomes mystery. In other words, if you try to press back and back and back to the origin and meaning of life, it becomes more and more of mystery. And I think that the more recent science, literature, and research, I think for a time in our science, research, technology, we were beginning to think of life as less and less of a mystery, as if we were coming closer and closer to figuring it all out. But all of a sudden, as we've gotten into the very tiny elements of life and the very cosmic elements of life, it becomes more of a mystery. And this is coming from science itself, that the more science gets into the very smallest elements of life and the very largest elements of life, it becomes more mysterious as you get to the primordial essence of life. Then the next thing he says is death as life's inevitable mystery. Death as mystery. Again, if you think of death as something that happens to people at a particular time and is caused by a particular disease or accident, then death becomes a problem. But if you think about how death functions as a part of life, that life comes out of death, that death seems to have some part in the whole scheme of things, then death becomes a part of the mystery. And in fact, if we're trying to come to terms with death in our own life or the life of others with us, at some point we've got to get off it as a problem and begin to think of its mystery elements, something we're never going to figure out exactly why the person died in terms of cause, why the person died in terms of what purpose does it serve. Finally comes the fact, in terms of the fact that people die, and what that full meaning is or the full cause is something that's beyond us. And it is only at that point that death, as meaningful to life, begins to be able to sink in. Nature and rebirth as recurring mysteries. Nature and rebirth. I'll read a few words from that. Nature itself, the repeated cycles of growth and death and rebirth as manifest in animate nature, trees, wildlife, flowers, the symbols of passionate life we find in the sea and in waterfalls and in rivers, the immensity of mountains, all these are for us also an experience of mystery. They cut so deeply into the unguarded world of our subconscious that they lodge there for centuries as meaningful symbols. How else do we explain the healing experience typified by the sea, or sitting by Railroad Creek or down on the dock at Chelan? The healing experience of the rebirth images of water, the warm, peaceful caresses conjured up by our memories of sunshine. I think that's what kind of thing that we experience at Holden, is the mysteries of nature and rebirth. He refers to sexual activity. We were talking about that last night as one of the mysteries, and that if finally we press sex to the problem to the situation of it being a problem to solve or a technique to be mastered, then we have really lost the meaning of sexual activity and the impact of it. Finally, that is a part of the mystery of nature. Another person has a mystery of life. Think again of the relationships. Probably the equality between husband and wife. I'd guess that what's happening over there is to get some of the mystery in the other person rather than as a figuring out how to get along with another person. Is to see that other person as a part of the mystery that's not going to be solved, but is there to be enjoyed, to be challenged by, to respond to. Love as a mystery of life. Evil as a constant mysterious presence. So even to see evil as a part of the mystery of life. And there he is dealing with this thing of why is it that despite our best intentions, why is it that despite our advances technologically and scientifically, why is it that evil seems constantly to be interjecting itself into these things? We talked about this a little bit in terms of The Fate of the Earth, Jonathan Schell's book on the discovery of nuclear energy, how in a sense that is a great breakthrough into the mysteries of life, but then almost immediately becomes a weapon of destruction of life. Well, that's, and we're looking at it here as a problem to be solved, but I think what Fox is saying, that that's the fact that that constitutes a problem. That seems always to be there. We never can get off the hook and finally get it solved. That's part of the mystery of life. Evil is there. And then, is that the last one? Let's see. Okay, those are six of the mysteries of life that makes life mystery. And Matthew Fox is saying that to deal with life on an adult basis means to deal with life as mystery. The biblical passage that came to my mind that, again, kind of affirms this understanding of life as mystery wasn't a passage, it's a book, the book of Job. The encounter between Job and his friends and between Job and God. And Job approaches his vast misfortunes to his property, to his family, and finally to his own body. The question is, why is this happening to me? Why is God doing this to me? And the friends come, and remember, they help him, try to help him to solve that problem. And what is the final outcome? Well, in chapter 41, God is speaking to Job from a whirlwind. After all of this talk, God speaks out of a whirlwind. And it's a long section, a couple of chapters long, and so I'm reaching into one part of it. Can you draw out Leviathan with a fishhook? He's talking to Job, but I think Job here represents the human species. Can you draw out Leviathan, that's the great fish, with a fishhook, maybe a whale? Or press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many supplications to you? Will he speak to you soft words? Will he make a covenant with you or take him for your servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird, or will you put him on a leash for your maidens? Will traders bargain over him? Will they divide him up among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay hands on him. Think of the battle. You will not do it again. Behold, the hope of a man is disappointed. He is laid low even at the height of him. No one is so fierce that he dares to stir Leviathan up. Who then is he that can stand before me, God? Who has given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. So God's response, keep in mind whose all of this is, who called this into being. Who are you to think that you can understand or get an answer as to exactly how this works? This has been called into being by God, who's behind it all. You are a mere human species. And then Job answers finally, I know that thou canst do all things, and that no purpose of thine can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Hear, and I will speak. I will question you, and you declare to me. I had heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees thee. Therefore I despise myself, and repent in dust and ashes. So finally, Job comes to terms with what is happening to him, in the idea that this is mystery, that is too much for him to comprehend. And so his response is to repent in dust and ashes. Now, I think there's then would be another chapter to the story of Job. I think the point here is not that there's nothing that Job can or ought to do in the face of this misfortune. But before he can say yes or no and say it effectively, he has to put it into some larger context. And he has to realize that this finally is not a problem to be solved, but a mystery, a part of the mystery of life. And then once he can put it in that context, then the yes and no that has to do with what he'll do in a particular situation can unfold. And then the third thing that Bach says about life is that... is that it's good. It's real, it's mystery, and the realness and the mystery is finally good. It is good rather than evil. And I was saying that I think our answers reflected that basically the mysteries, the adventure, the complications, the choices, finally life is good rather than essentially evil. And I mentioned that Richard Niebuhr made the point, H. Richard, that life is good finally because we trust in the one who brings it into being as good. So this finally is a faith statement. It is by faith, standing before the mystery, that we say it is good, because the one who brings it into being is good and can be trusted. Scripturally, I think we don't have to go past the first chapter of Genesis to see this affirmation of life as good. And God saw it, and it was good. And I think the way that Scripture records the creation of earth, I think even for the time in which it was written, it would be considered a non-scientific or literally descriptive recording of creation. I don't think it's solely because Genesis was written before science was perfected, but because in describing how life came into being, there was an understanding of the mystery of life. And so you tell how life came into being in story form. You don't want it to reduce it to actual minutes and hours and particular actions and processes. But you want to say God did it, and he did this. He brought this into being, and it was one day. And he brought this into being, and it was another day. And this is how the night fit in with the day. And then the animals and the birds come in. This is how they fit in with the night and the day. And finally, here's how the human species come in, and how here this fits in. I think intentionally to preserve the mystery of this. So life was not something we finally can get a handle on and nail down. And then we don't need any reference to the Creator from that point on. Now, so that we get to the part, a different understanding of prayer, I need to connect this with prayer. Matthew Fox says that prayer is the wholehearted response to life as mystery. We could say life, prayer is response to life as mystery, but Fox wants to say it's a response of the whole being. So there's a chapter in the book on what prayer is not. And for Fox, he's saying prayers are not something that you say before you go to bed. I think if you work through the understanding of prayer, then the conversation with God or the voicing verbally of the concerns of the day become a part of prayer. But prayer is something much more. Prayer is the total response of the individual to life as mystery. So that if you sit up there at the end of Honeymoon Heights and just look out and don't say a word, but are almost drawn outside of yourself by the view and just any initial meditation, that's prayer, because that's the response of the being to the mystery of life. Or you can sit on a porch or a chalet here. And last night when we was about 11 o'clock, I guess. We were coming out of one of the chalets, and someone in the group said, "Look up." And we looked up, and there were the stars, just the silhouettes of the mountains. Now, I think the word "look up" was prayer, as Matthew Fox is referring to it. It was a spontaneous expression or response to the mystery of life. Specifically, prayer is rooting oneself in life. Well, I'm going to have to say read the book to get the whole story, but one part of prayer, one part of this response, the total self to the mysteries of life, is to intentionally become more rooted in it. This is one of those seemingly contradictory statements that we find ourselves making in relation to the faith. Fox is saying that we are indeed rooted in life. We can't withdraw from life. The fact that we're in a body means that we are rooted in life. We have to be a part of life to live. But then he says we ought consciously to seek more firmly to root ourselves into life. And the way we do that, some of the things he mentions, is just to become aware of what's going on. Some of our initial statements about what Holden has to do with all of this is that Holden, if we let ourselves, let it happen to us, is a rooting experience. It almost forces us to be aware of the mysteries of nature and of creation. I think it encourages us to be rooted in the mystery of other individuals. I made this big point about the other night that Holden isn't any help in distinguishing who is who. Well, if we're immediately impressed with the fact that Chuck Mayer is the campus pastor at Capital University in Columbus, Ohio, and we're told that right at the beginning, before anyone have a chance to know him another way, the mystery is taken out of him. Oh, he's campus pastor at Capital. We know what campus pastors are and do. Some of us know Capital University. Others know Columbus, Ohio, and we've got him pretty well figured out. He's not even a problem anymore, unless we have a problem with Columbus or Capital or campus pastor. But if he's introduced as Chuck or Chuck Mayer, he's a mystery. The mystery is there, and we need to deal with him as he is, draw our own conclusions, and I think Holden encourages that. This is what Matthew Fox is saying. We need intentionally to root ourselves in life, to deal with those mysteries that he mentioned to us. And then he is saying that the more rooted we become in life, the more a part of the mystery we become and understand it as mystery, the more we feel that life is good. And then this word ecstasy, which I picked up as a major term, it's in his book, he doesn't pick it up as a major term, but ecstasy as one of the responses to life as mystery. And this total response isn't, ecstasy is not saying, "Oh, isn't that nice?" or "I'm feeling good at the moment," or "it's pretty," which can be very intellectual statements or surface statements, but this sense of ecstasy, being so rooted in the mystery of life and so impressed by its goodness that we're literally drawn out of ourselves, come beside ourselves with the goodness of life, that response of ecstasy. And that's one form of prayer, as Fox understands it. Ecstasy, this total response to the goodness of life. So that, and again, that's not always verbalized or even acted out. It's there, it's a response. Now, the other side of it is that the more we become rooted in life and the goodness of it and the ecstatic experience in life, the more obvious become those things which threaten to destroy life, to detract from its goodness. And again, the example that we've been using here, the threat of nuclear destruction to life. The more ecstatic we become, and in this experience and feeling how life, good life is, and then realize that there's something out there that can destroy this, so that it's no longer there, poof, and destroy us so that we're not here to appreciate it. Then we don't say, "Gee, that's too bad," or "We've really got to solve this problem and get time," or "I wish it weren't the case," but we become angry, even to the point of outrage, outrage that there should be something there that threatens to destroy the goodness of life, that which makes us ecstatic. And that's the other side of prayer then. And that also is a part of prayer, the outrage, as Fox is saying. So that's why I'm saying prayer is wholehearted response to life as mystery. In other words, he's saying we've got to get ourselves so enmeshed in life that we're overcome by life. And when that's the case, then we can't react to what threatens to life in anything more than an emotion that is equally as deep, but the opposite, which is outrage. And so he's saying the more deeply we are rooted in life, and the more extreme our emotions of ecstasy on the one hand and outrage on the other, the more prayerful we are, the more in prayer we are. That's prayer. That's why I'm saying this is another understanding of prayer from ways in which we often think of it. Then I think what we verbalize in terms of the prayer of the church when the congregation are invited to respond, or in our individual prayer when we are attempting to verbalize the feelings that we have or addressing petitions, then these are informed by these feelings of ecstasy and outrage. So it's not that the words don't need to be said then, but the words are informed by these deep emotions toward life. Now I want to connect this then to the politics of hope, and let's see if I have a particular passage that's lost in here. Let's see if I can find it. Yeah. Oops. It's not in this book. Put that aside. Page 115. Fox says the prophet is the person who is most consumed by outrage, and the prophet is the one who most understands the need to uproot. He's talked about getting ourselves rooted in life, and the more rooted in life we are, the more ecstatic, the more angry we become at those things that threaten life, and see those as things that need to be uprooted. And the prophet, or the prophet in us, is the one that is trying to uproot. So we're in these two processes, becoming rooted, and because of that, needing to uproot. And then he says, from time to time, the prophet's, this is the uprooter, the prophet's sole sustaining power may be hope. Politics of hope. Hope. Which, of course, is not optimism. Hope is not optimism. Optimism is just saying things are going to come out okay. Hope, though, is the capacity to sustain one's belief that life is a gift when all else seems to dictate otherwise. Hope means that the power to deal with evil powers is greater than oneself and must ultimately triumph, that the gates of hell shall not prevail. Now, I think that's a good definition of hope. It's intended in that politics of hope thing. Hope is something that becomes meaningful when we are most outraged, most confronted with those things that threaten to destroy or to harm life. And hope then is that motivation that causes us to think that we can do something about it. No matter how powerful the powers of evil or of destruction seem to be, hope is the capacity to sustain one's life, that life is a gift, that life is good, when all else seems to dictate otherwise. Hope means that the power to deal with evil powers is greater than oneself, even greater than the community, and must ultimately triumph, though the gates of hell shall not prevail. The politics of hope, then, would be those things that we decide to do as a result of the hope that we have that the goodness of life will finally prevail. So there is that action side of it, and that gets back to the yes and no, that at some point, informed by our ecstasy and our outrage, we are going to have to say yes to some things and say no to some other things. Generally, we would say yes to the things that cause the ecstatic experience. We would say no to those things that outrage. But if our no is to be effective, then there must be some way of putting them into action. That's the politics side of it. So the politics, the action of hope that comes out of hope. That takes us exactly to 11:45, and there's no further opportunity for discussion. But I think the questions or responses that you would have would be dealt with if you read the book. It's not a long book. It's not a difficult book. So I'd encourage you even to read a chapter of it, so if you have it here. So if the subject is intriguing, read the book.
You have to decide to read the whole book, because the first chapters on what prayer isn't will shake all of your prayer expectations, and you'll be really mad at the author.
Okay, maybe even outraged.
It's in the bookstore.
Yeah.
It also comes in a record.
It does? Oh, okay. The session is over.